fellow in the white shirt here is Randy Lyle. Randy's a division chief here in the local unit for CDF. He was an integral player in the first parts of the start, actually for the entire life of the Cedar Fire. Tom Porter's right here. Tom's the forester here in the unit. And today's tour is really just about looking at the firescape out there and getting out and hearing from Randy and hearing about what the conditions were on the ground. This is really a fire protection post-fire, kind of get you a feel for what was and is one of the largest fires in the history of California, at least in CDF right here. This is the Cedar Fire you can see on the map. One of the things that we discovered as we go through our 12-hour periods on the incident action plan, we make a progression map, a fire progression map that shows where the fire goes and changes in each 12 hours. That information was taken by some folks at San Diego State University and matched up with the topography, matched up with the weather, and they put those things together to make a fire progression, an animated fire progression map on a topographic background. And that's what we're going to show you this morning, I think, is both the, you have both the Cedar and the Paradise fires on there, or just the Cedar?
No, I've got them both.
It was. We're going to look at the Cedar fire.
Yes.
And then anything else you want to tell them? And that's really all we're going to do here, give you an idea of where we're going to go, what we're going to do, and then we'll get on the bus and go there.
Okay.
Okay, so Randy, why don't you tell them what you got here?
Okay, well, what's on the screen right now, just because it has to be there as my background, is that's a shot of some of the wildflowers coming back in the upper Green Valley meadow on the way up to the camp that I normally work at. So every day I drive by there, you know, I get some shots of this kind of thing going on. But the Cedar Fire progression here, built by San Diego State, there was some enhancements from some satellite imagery and some satellite data that was also incorporated into this. And so we'll just run it. What you'll see is a little red spot. It's the beginning of the fire. 15-minute intervals, they were extrapolated from the satellite and from the other data. Anyways, you'll see the fire, and the scene will go dark and light to kind of coincide with daylight and then darkness. The fire starts at approximately 5:15, give or take a few minutes, Saturday evening. So we'll just go ahead and run it, let it speak for itself, and then there it is, right there. It's sundown, Saturday evening. Now watch this. Sunday morning about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock-ish. The areas that are staying red inside the burn are, of course, where there's residual latent heat. These are dates down here that aren't showing up real well at this resolution.
It's the day the wind turned around.
That's right. It's Monday about noon right now. And Monday evening is when it blew into Julian, or around Julian, and as the case was. It's just a little piece right up here in the upper left. Pretty much it. We're pretty close to being done now. That little piece, again, this one right here, and that's it. That's it for the animation. That corresponds with this piece right here. This is the piece that flared up and burned over Steve Rucker and his crew. Killed him there in Wainola.
Let's just go ahead and run this one again. Can you run it back?
Sure.
You can stop and start the top of it by tapping the mouse back, right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, let's get it back to the start position. We didn't orient you looking at that. Go ahead and start it.
Okay,
Randy, and get the stop once you get
it. Sure.
Stop right.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry.
We didn't orient you down at the bottom here is Mission Bay, is where we are down here. And of course, San Diego Harbor is here, looking towards Julian up at the very top. Go ahead and run it now, okay. And then stop it when I can give you a holler.
Okay.
And you can see the first 24 hours of this are clearly wind driven. It starts in the San Diego River drainage. And this is the first night. They have fatalities in that drainage where you're looking there. Now, on the next morning, and I'll stop it rather than just down the base. Keep going with the right there. Now, that's where it's ran into the city of San Diego, to Scripps Ranch, and down to Miramar, Naval Air Station, actually Marine Air Station now. Miramar right here. It actually ran up. That, it covered that, that was 30 miles that it covered in the first burning period. So you can imagine picking a place 30 miles from your home, wherever you live. Think of a place that's 30 miles away. And seeing on the news the night before, oh, there's a little fire up there. Well, gosh, that, you know, I hope they get that out wherever it is. The next morning, opening your front door, and the fire's coming in the front door 30 miles away. That's what these people were faced with down at Scripps Ranch, down to the drains. That was the major wind-driven event. Go ahead. Let's start again. Now, it's spread out as far as it's spread. Now, it goes down through Harvest and Canyon to the right, a lot more damage there. Now, the wind it essentially stops for all intents and purposes, driving by the side of the road. Now, it's turned into a fuel and topography given fire the other way to the east. That's all upslope we're looking at now. So now we're faced with what is about a 25 or 30 mile fire front going the other way. And the battle for Julian, as newspapers put it, starts now. Yeah, we're in this. You'll see it. Things are up towards Julian, up in the upper left-hand corner, right up through there. And we're across this night, right in there. And Chief Lyle was integral. He was the commander on the ground fighting for Julian. They're still standing because he's still standing. Now you'll notice that all the heat's gone except for in the extreme right left-hand corners. The fire's quiet. This is the time that firefighter Rucker was killed. Yeah, right in through there. The fire's quiet almost everywhere. People have let their guards down. We're one day past, right?
Yeah, we are now.
We're one day past. But that upper left-hand corner there, where the rest of the fire was quiet, and that's typical of these kinds of tragedies and accidents, tend to be when the fire calms down, and it's on some place where we're just, it's just, that's one of the common denominators. Watch out for that. And after that, it was pretty much, it ran into the old Pines Fire burn on the upper, all the upper side of that really runs into the Pines Fire from the year before. And then it's a matter of getting around it. About two-thirds of that's SRA, and about a third of it is on the Cleveland National Forest. I think that's about right. That's about right.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's it's a pretty interesting thing. I think you'll see a lot more of these enhancements. It's a really good graphic story of how it went and where it went.
Yeah, real quick, this drainage right here is the San Diego River drainage. We're going to be stopping for lunch right about here where the shadow is, and we'll be able to kind of look down that a little bit. It's probably the largest visual geographic feature in San Diego County. You can see it from the air. You can see it real, you know, real good on the map. And that corresponds, again, with this piece right here, and I'm sure that the funneling effect that it had on that west wind had an influence on that right there. If there's not any questions, we'll pack up and get going, because that was pretty. We just kind of wanted to give you a quick orientation of what we'll be seeing, and then go see it. But now you have a little better feel for, you know, the overall, you know, picture of what we'll be looking at. Yeah.
Are we going to be back here by 3?
That was the plan.
Yes.
Yes.
Some of us have planes to catch, so I just wanted to put that little.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that back here at 3 or at the airport at 3? Pardon?
Is the bus going to the airport?
Bus can go to the airport, but we certainly need to take the luggage that needs to go to the airport. You know what I'm saying?
How many total acres involved in?
273,000. Anything else?
Before you put that down.
Okay. Yep.
This drainage was in line with the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And at that, about 16 and a half hours, the wind did lessen. It did. The fire did run out of fuel right on the flaming front. But had the wind continued as it does for several days, typically, we only had really the one night of wind, and then it lessened. But had it continued, this drainage is full of decadent vegetation, and it would have sent that fire right to the coast through some pretty high-dollar real estate. So we lucked out in some respects, or the city lucked out in some respects in that at that point. So
we're just
point out Scripps Ranch.
Scripps Ranch is right in this area.
What were the total fatalities in the fire?
17 is what they're saying now, including the firefighter. And we're going to drive up Verona Valley, where most but not all those fatalities were. We'll try to point some of the others out on the road as we're going. Any questions? More questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the cause of the fire, or was it determined? And what kind of vegetation did it burn?
It was a hunter lighting a signal fire mechanism, specific mechanism, exactly unknown. That hasn't been released. But it was a hunter. It was a signal fire. He was lost. And it was started in an area of medium to large brush, if you will. Fuel model 4, certainly fuel model 4, old growth, if you will, decadent brush. But it wasn't real continuous like a carpet. There were some breaks in it. It wasn't, all that homogeneous in its distribution.
Did he survive?
Yeah, the sheriff helicopter rescued him, pulled him off. I actually hiked out to the origin because we were doing some fire behavior analysis work for some post-fire analysis, and we needed to know exactly where it started because that was what the fire behavior analyst needed. He needed to know where it started so we could run his models. And we actually found the place where they set the helicopter down. We saw the skids. We saw a bunch of real strange flagging that when we did some checking, and we were told, yeah, you found it. That's it. And this is what this was, and that's what that was. We found a rock where they had made a cross with the flagging in that, and that was the origin. He actually built, it was on a knob, a rocky knob. It had a rock cap on it, if you will. And he built the fire itself, the initial fire, up on the rocks. Not real far up on the rocks, but it was up on the rocks. It wasn't out in the brush. And that's really all I know about that, because they weren't real liberal with their details.
Bear in mind, that was on the Cleveland National Forest and the civil investigation.
And we're dealing with Forest Service investigators. Yeah, exactly. So what we were going to do today was run that Interstate 8 past 805, and if I remember to point that out to you, we're going to be down here. If you were to look straight north, you'd catch this first edge of the fire. We're going to come all the way into 8 to 67 to Wildcat Canyon Road, go up through Verona, end up ultimately over here at San Diego Country Estates, where we'll talk about all this in detail out there, but just to orient you, where the fire first came across the canyon and began to interact with the structures. And then we'll come out through this way up here for lunch, and then time permitting, we'll come down through the park either as fast or as slow as we need to get you back on time. But running back down Interstate 8, interesting thing, the old Viejas fire of January 2000, 10,000 acres burned a nice narrow swath right through here. Tiny little slop over Interstate 8, one of the very few places in the first, when this thing was burning hot, it says 1027-0600, this green color. One of the very few places that airdrops were effective in catching it, and I attribute that to the fact that this was previously burned fuel, and we were able to get in. It was burning with less intensity. Its resistance to control wasn't the same as it was in many of these other places. And when the wind was blowing, there wasn't a lot of effect. But nonetheless, a little piece of retardant line right there caught a little piece of the fire. And I'm sure it wanted to do, here's Interstate 8, and this whole piece slopped over. This could have been the same thing here were it not for the aircraft and the old burn.
Okay, shall we get on the bus and go? Get back in time.
We're looking at an aspect about like this, and we can only see, it's not this big knob here, it's not the one in the distance, but we're seeing a piece of one that's cut like this and cut like this. Okay?
Yeah.
Are you with me? That's Cedar Creek, and that knob right there is the origin of the fire. That's it.
It's real popular out here. Saved a lot of people.
It goes down into that one that's cut like this, cut like this. That's Cedar Creek, and that knob right there is that's it. We're from the Forest Service. They're sitting here looking at that thing. They can see the whole thing getting bigger and bigger, like I said. Well, slowly getting bigger and bigger because they can see the whole circle of the fire. So it's on that knob. And ultimately, it went out of sight. And the high ground, not Eagle Peak, not this real Razorback, but the one I was calling Sunshine Mountain. We're kind of looking at this face of it. It goes back. It runs back a spine like this. It runs like this. We're seeing the fire lick up every once in a while from over there. We're back over that Eagle Peak, the very peak.
That valley behind us almost?
Yeah, we're back behind it. Basin. Way back there, yeah. Good ways back there.
The fire source was this side of that humpback ridge there?
I'm sorry, the first part again?
The ignition source.
The ignition source is on this green slope. We can see like a pie-shaped piece. You can see the top of the slope, and then this is this hill right here, and this aspect, or this cut, that's Cedar Creek flowing right through that. Gosh, I wish there was some way I could point with a laser pointer. But the origin of this fire, okay, here's the best I can do. In the background, on the farthest ridge line, there's one that's got like a little dimple in the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, come down to the right at like maybe 5 o'clock from there, and you can see a pronounced, it's green, and what mm-hmm. we're seeing is the ridge line, and then there, it's
right.
We're this and this are blocking the view. That's Cedar Creek, and up on the top of that, there's really nothing to describe there, but on the top of that ridge, that was the origin.
This is Cedar Creek right here then.
That's exactly so right.
What was and you say it skunked around for about 4 hours?
About 5 or 6 actually. Yeah. From
so
5 till 5.
That was a 5 o'clock ignition.
Yeah.
How long till it got here?
It got here. We figured it hit here approximately, again, I'm going by memory here, but about 12:30. 12:31, between 12:30 and 1, I'm going to stay closer to 1 now.
So it had a kind of a slow build up to get.
Well, it stayed there with no wind on it till 11:30. So then it went. So the real spread was from 11:30 to 12:30. So it was here lickety split.
That's about 5 miles up there on the ridge.
The wind off
speed. Probably it was probably running 25-30. Yeah.
Consistent. I mean, it wasn't gusting. It was
no. Low. Once it laid down, it that was it. And you could see it was blowing at the upper elevations. I mean, because the column was just laying right over here, burned right underneath the column, just like they do. So
where'd they evacuate all these people to? And the route was the same route that we came up.
Yeah. They went out two ways. At first, while they could, they went out of the estates, and the estates sort of, we're right here now, as a matter of fact. At first, they went out the estates and went into Ramona, but ultimately that got cut off, and they had to go back down Wildcat Canyon, but that was early on. This was before the fire ran down Wildcat Canyon, because they would not have been able to do that ultimately. Okay, so the fire hits. There's some homes right over here. It hits there first, and from the air, there's two or three real distinct canyons that the structures were built right there on the edge, right there on the precipice. And the fire is also now burning up on Mount Gower, okay, which are these hillsides here. Yeah, and it's begun to run across Barona Mesa, which is up here. This goes up and flattens out. The development turns into larger, more spread out fuel model four again, like little ranches, if you will, 2, 3, 4, 5 acres in that up there. But in through here, there's a lot of green belt, a lot of wick type of vegetation in that to drag the fire and pull it in amongst the houses. And it burned in some places from house or spotted from house to house. There's a lot of long-range spotting going on with the fire, and a lot of very extreme flame lengths. Probably 40, 50, 60 foot in here, yeah.
Have we got a little bit of time to talk about the vegetation? Here or at another spot?
Yeah, sure.
We could
maybe
a little bit.
Yeah, because I'm...
The vegetation... The effects on the vegetation is still being studied. However, a lot of what is being seen so far is that it was the fire didn't cause much real damage to the vegetation as a whole, and meaning the communities. Most everything out here has already started to resprout or has seeded. A lot of wildflowers have been showing up that haven't been seen in a lot of these areas for many, many, many years. And it's also been noticed, though, we have at this location, of course, we have mustard and some other exotics coming in. There are vast areas back away from the developed areas that no non-natives are coming in. So it's for the vegetative community, it's probably been of little effect or of benefit for the most part for the vast area of the fire. Very little, maybe 2% of the fire was mapped as being as burning at intensities high enough to burn the seed bed up. Unfortunately, a lot of those areas were up in the forested area in the park, and so we're going to have to see what happens as far as soil sterilization and seed bed issues up there, and we'll get to that later in the day. But if you find, as we're traveling around today and stop in the park, if we're lucky enough to do so, if you find any seedlings, let me know so I can document those, and we'll keep moving on with monitoring. There are a couple of monitoring things going on. The UC Extension is getting ready to embark on and has started through some of their own individual groups, embarked on some static photo points where they're taking photos every quarter from the same location and at the same view. And then we have, through cooperation with some of the web-based cams that are available, one's on Mount Woodson, which is behind us here on the other side of Ramona, and you may have seen some of those progression of the fire photos that were done by a static camera. Those were done by this gentleman's group out of the University of California at San Diego, and through a cooperative program with Scripps that they have these cameras set up, and they have set up additional cameras to look at the vegetation change over time, and they're taking a picture every 2 minutes and then archiving these. And then they also, some of them have a trigger, so if some motion occurs, they'll take a picture. So they have pictures of golden eagles swooping by the front of the camera and that kind of thing. It's kind of interesting. And if you're interested, I'll give out my card and you can email me. I'll email you the address to that at some point.
So we're looking right up the San Diego River Valley?
Cedar Creek goes that way. San Diego River drainage kind of cuts off at this angle. This is the San Diego River drainage closest to us and straight down.
And Julian is just on the side of that hill?
Julian is back up there. You've got Cuyamac up proper, Middle Peak, North Peak, and Julian would be behind those hills out there with the oaks.
One of the questions is, how would you maintain a diversity of vegetation types out here? It could all go to chaparral and form a continuous cover and just close in again. But there's some thought going on about how we could maintain some of the clearances and some of the, and we have Eric here who will describe some of his interests. And introduce yourself.
I'm Eric Anderson. I'm a local farmer from North County on the coast. I was actually a participant in the 96 Harmony Grove fire, which is more participation I ever wanted to have. I participated in the multi-habitat conservation programs, and as we looked at the habitat types and how it used to be and what it's become, you used to have grasslands. This would have been, in the early days, a needlegrass meadow with isolated patches of chaparral. And that's what it is south of the border, where you still have a lot of free-burning areas which tend to burn themselves out. Since we've been doing intervention, we've allowed the chaparral to become the dominant area, and you've got 100,000 acres of one habitat type, which is a huge fuel load. You can either take care of it mechanically with bulldozers and big fire breaks, and you have to make big ones. As you saw, they did jump the freeway. Or you can have prescribed burns, which politically I think are very difficult in San Diego County. Or you can have agriculture be part of the working landscape and be part of the habitat programs, and to reduce the fuel loads, especially around the clustered developments. This was become a controversial type of land use pattern, where you have a clustered development with open space. And our idea is, if we have some ag in between the wildland habitats, you'll have a much lower problem when the chaparral does burn in this type of thing. So
by agriculture, you mean
grazing, but it is the main type. There's other types too. That in San Diego, your imagination is the limit of what type of ag you could do. But there's other types of agriculture, but primarily grazing is your biggest way to, and cheapest way to prevent chaparral from regrowing and becoming a fuel load that for these guys to deal with in the middle of a firestorm. So if you have questions about the native plants and things that we do harvest some of them, and also do that. Or, any questions?
Thanks.
I wanted to make a comment on the burning. You're right in that for us to burn large quantities of acreage each year, it's difficult. However, the Forest Service and CDF have a real good working relationship, and we can get burns accomplished. It has more to do with cooperating landowners than it does environmental issues or smoke management issues for us here in San Diego right now. But a point here in this particular location, we've been working for 3 years with the Forest Service to put together what is named and we have grant money for through the WUI grants, the San Vicente Community Protection Program, which encompasses this entire area, including Barona. We had a system of fuel breaks proposed off of some of these truck trails, one of which you can see going off, well, we could when we pulled in, but it goes off up the canyon here. Mount Gower was going to receive several burns. There's another hill on the other side of this that we came by when we were coming through Barona that was Indian Head. We were going to have a prescribed burn there as well, and we obviously just didn't get to it before this came through.
Up by the Santa Isabel area, you guys have been doing some prescribed burns.
Yes.
Up in here, and that helped keep it from going up this way.
Yeah,
well, even though that there is quite a bit of chaparral and habitat up here, they work. I mean, prescribed burns work really well by reducing the fuel load, reinvigorating the habitat. You get, like you said, a lot of great wildflowers that come back, and it's healthy for the vegetation community.
That's right.
Hard to do on. You've got a real mix in San Diego County, especially of ownerships. And especially as you get west of here, it gets a little bit more difficult with the private landowners.
Is there like a total figure of the cost to the state of protecting these remote subdivisions?
Do you have the... Are you talking about during this fire?
No,
or are you talking about in
like
general?
In general, and is there some, like, recompensation or something like that to the state by the residents and developers?
That sounds like an SRA fee. I don't have a comment on... I mean... That sounds like the SRA fee that you're referring to, which is something that's going on.
I guess sort of a related question is, you know, like, for example, one of these big fires from last October, how much of your time, very roughly, was spent doing structural fire protection as opposed to wildland fire protection?
During the fire?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, in the initial Saturday night, Sunday, Monday, into Monday, there was probably very little perimeter control going on, and does that kind of make between structure protection and perimeter control? There was probably very little perimeter control work Saturday night, certainly Sunday, probably maybe 5% perimeter control up until Monday when the wind kind of quit and the column stood straight up, and then. And then we shifted more into perimeter control until the wind established itself again, you know, late Monday. And then in Tuesdays where we were back in structure protection mode, at least in the Julian area, but it was more perimeter control over here on the other side. So on a timeline, there was very little and then some and then mixed. And then ultimately the structure protection finished, and it was all perimeter control, and then it was all perimeter control for the remainder of the incident. So, if I had to chop it up into percentages on the whole, probably, and this is it won't be an accurate picture because it, you know, probably maybe 15-20% on structure protection and the rest perimeter control, but that's dragging this thing all the way out to its conclusion, which ran a very long time. In the beginning, it was all structure protection.
Chief, I have a question. On the community fire safety system, our land use planning, looks like this neighborhood here survived. What's your assessment, I guess, of the pre-fire situation relative to the preparedness of this community in terms of its building or its clearing space or its fuel conditions on the wildland? How would you assess this as successful or average or good or bad, I guess, in a sense?
From a pre-fire perspective?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, as being prepared.
Well, they had a real good project in process, but it was in the planning process. Had they been able to implement that fully, it would have made a huge difference right here, and not only right here, but maybe further downstream as far as the fire goes. As it was, I think that the community was served pretty well by our typical defensible space, homeowner association clearance that they had done in the past, and then the work that the firefighters did at the time of the fire.
So you would say that this is a satisfactory community setting for, you know, given the houses and the threat and...
Yeah, I'd give it a C. I mean,
I didn't hear the question. Sorry about that.
It was from a pre-fire perspective, and readiness for a fire to come through here. What did I think of this right here? And then I said, you know, given the fact that the big project that was on the books that wasn't finished here hadn't taken place yet, I give it about a C. Not bad. I mean, certainly wasn't a failure.
No,
lose only 25 homes here, and again, I realize every one is a loss.
Yeah.
But numerically, to lose 25 homes in a situation like this, with I don't know, probably a mile of fire or better coming at us, with the full force of the wind and all the rest of that, was in my mind pretty good success.
The homes here are newer construction that I can see. They're very fire resistant that I can see right here, and that certainly helped a lot.
Yeah, sure.
Is there? I missed the first part of Chris's question, but is there a fire safe, active fire safe council in this area?
Starting. There is one starting up as we speak. Post fire, there was
pre-fire, there was some startup discussions, but no Fire Safe Council formally.
There's a homeowners association here that does enforce some clearance regulations and does, in fact, effect some clearance and fuel modification around the perimeter. And so that was a part of what was already in place. It wasn't nearly to the extent that this cooperative project was going to be. Now, there's fire history in this area. There was a fire Mother's Day in 1992 that started down in the bottom and burned up, but it took a more southerly route. It didn't go around this way, but it burned across Verona Mesa.
I was here then. I remember that.
Yeah, I remember that one well, too. And this one, that fire was what prompted the guys that were here on this side to be so adamant about what they anticipated to happen. And again, don't forget, we're over here. We can't see them. They can't see us. We can't see the fire, but they can see the fire. So we've got this sort of triangular thing going on with vantage points and feeding one another information and so forth. And it was a very complicated first few hours of an incident.
So in this setting, with the chaparral is, you know, obviously right to the back doors of these homes and some areas.
Yes.
If the Fire Safe Councils came in and said, we'd like to build a 200-foot fuel modification zone around the perimeter of the community, what steps would they have to go through? What hindrances would there be to that process?
Tom would help me out on this, but it would be basically to develop a VMP project. It would be a collaborative effort in this area, probably with CDF, with the Forest Service, the Homeowners Association. I don't know, I'm not sure how the...
Any permits, if any, required?
Whose land is this? Well, that's what I'm going to say, yeah, is I'm not sure what right. land is held in common, so right. I'm not sure. Yeah.
But assuming there was the landowner gave permission to do the work, et cetera, are there any permitting processes, any consultations that would have to be done?
Yeah, it would be the ARC surveys, we've got a programmatic EIR that would cover our regular VMP program, yeah. Other than that, I don't...
For this particular instance, right behind all of these homes, there is a private strip that was built into the subdivision plan, but it's federal ground right behind that. And so going 200 feet is not going to happen. I believe there is a 100-foot, I'm going to call it an easement, but that's a liberal use of easement. There's a 100-foot fuel modification zone that goes around the back of these homes in this area.
But that easement wasn't designed for fuel modification. It was designed for ingress and egress control, wasn't it, initially?
Well, it's fuel modification zone. Okay. There is a fuel modification zone in most of these subdivision areas out in the
Then to go out further for a better safe zone, then it gets into federal issues, and now we're into the NEPA standards.
Exactly. It would be some sort of an EA would have to be...
Section 7 consultations.
Exactly.
Tom, do you think that 100 feet right here in this setting, right against these houses, is enough, or what would your guys' ideal recommendation be? Just off the cuff, I mean, do you think that's, like you said, average, good enough in this setting, given these houses and newness of them?
Real good 100-foot clearance here that was zoned properly and all, and maintained recently and all, would have probably made a considerable difference here. I'm not sure it would be 100% adequate, but it certainly would have been better than what was here then. But you can look, I mean, these skeletons, they're if I'm not mistaken, there wasn't a lot inside them, at least not heavy like this.
Right.
It was cleared fairly well. It wasn't too bad.
How many houses in the whole
I couldn't say. Honestly, yeah, at least. Yeah.
And of the 25 lost, what portion of those were due to, say, you know, the fire pass, some embers, and it was building material
That's
related?
That's right. Good question. Yeah. The majority of them were ember attack. They were not direct flame impingement. And some of them, from what I gather, had been, the firemen, firefighters were here.
the protective structure, the fire blew through. They came back after they thought that it was okay to leave. They left, came back, and the house was on fire again. And that scenario played out a few times right in here. Yeah, so ember attack equals building construction or design.
Feds do, though, have the ability now in these types of fuel breaks, fuel modification zones, to use the categorical exclusion with a change in the administration's policy about 6 months ago, where they can come in where there isn't a lot of vegetation to change. They can do that under a pretty brief process.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that will hopefully help.
Yeah,
specifically for projects like this.
Yes, my understanding that the feds are going to rely more on fuel modification, that their pre-fire efforts are going to rely on fuel modification more heavily in the future.
And where the federal folks down here are starting to have problems, and they have been for the last probably 3 to 5 years, is where there's critical land next to private land next to an area where they're trying to put in a fuel break or fuel modification zone, and they really need the cooperation of that landowner. They have no way to go after a contract to cooperate with that landowner except through us. And right now, for over a year and a half now, our MOU to work with federal agencies has been it's not in effect. It's sunsetted, and we haven't renewed it at this point. We're still working on that at the Sacramento level, but we don't, so we can't enter into a cooperative agreement with the federal partner. We can enter into a separate agreement with that landowner and then run what we would do as a seamless operation along that. But we can't do a cooperative burn, for instance, and just burn it like it's all federal or it's all state. We can't do that right now. We have to do a ceremonial passing of the drip torch or put a line in and cut the unit in pieces.
Is there a plan to follow up?
My understanding that is moving forward. It's just it's in a state of flux.
What species have it?
Exactly. And and there's 4 or 5 agencies that are involved in that. It's not us that are.
And what threatened or endangered species issues are associated with this type of habitat?
Gnatcatcher gets the most recognition. And any fish and game people here, please step up and help me. Okay, but they would typically be in coastal sage scrub, of which this isn't really coastal sage scrub.
Yeah,
but beyond, on the other side of the community, there's a water tank down lower that didn't burn. That hill over there, it's kind of a gray-green color. That would be coastal sage scrub. It's a lower, softer shrub type. Any other species that
leaf spells, virial,
possibly in the drainages along the
The leaf spell would be more drainage.
Okay.
Royal
okay.
toad's a possibility, but those are again I think more drainage.
Yeah. Yeah, no, if you meant right here or just in
general.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah.
In general those
habitat type.
It's a
Otai fire, Kino checker spot.
That's specific to vegetation type as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, in general chaparral not. I don't think there's any K-rats here.
Not right here, but there is in another part of Ramona, right over there.
Okay.
That's the only thing I can think of.
This
is part of the designated corridor.
MSCP, this is part of the multiple species conservation plan.
And they generally discourage you going out into the, even though it's chaparral and not a protected species, because it's covered by the habitat program. You're generally discouraged from disturbing them. So, true.
But those issues have not stopped us from doing projects. Other things have. Working with WUI grants and the finances that are around those has been a stumbling block on occasion to getting things moving fast. Any other? Are there others?
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Okay, got any more questions? Or is it time to move on? Or
hard questions.
Yeah. No, I don't have any questions.
No. Yeah, I think if we go, we could go ahead and go. It's a little too early for lunch, but we could go to the Inyaha Memorial at the upper end of the drainage and
just look down from there,
look down from there, talk about the Rucker thing maybe, and then go back down the hill and eat. Does that sound good? Okay. At the very headwaters, if you will, of the San Diego River. This is the top of that big drainage that runs all the way down and kind of terminates south of Interstate 8 there in the Harbison Canyon Crest area, and it funneled the fire in that one piece that slopped over on the map, that slopped over south of Interstate 8 that I kind of pointed out as I'm thinking. That's down at the other end of this drainage. And so we'll try to point it out as we're going by on Interstate 8. You can look back up the drainage. You can't see, of course, this far. But very little doubt that it had a funneling effect of the wind. You had the drainage, you had the wind in alignment, and then, of course, all the other factors in alignment that would, you know, be expected on a large damaging fire with the fuels and the weather, the topography. All of that really did start at the perfect time to have a bad fire. Started just after cutoff, just before the wind, at the beginning of a Santa Ana condition, during a prolonged drought, etc., etc. So everything was lined up. Inyaha Memorial that we passed by is a memorial erected to memorialize 11 firefighters died on a fire in November. Wind-driven fire, 1956, burned 43,000 some odd acres in one of the side drainages right around the corner, not far from here. They were caught. It was two Forest Service employees and nine Viejas road gang employees. It was a precursor to... I think it was like a county detention facility. The Forest Service gentleman that I mentioned earlier, his name is Carlton Joseph. He was named for one of the guys that died. His name was Lingo Carlton, and so that's where Carlton Joseph got his name. His dad was
on the fire, and he worked for the Forest Service. So Carlton was the original Forest Service IC, who then became, I became joint incident commander. I'm using jargon, maybe you don't know. Incident commander went on in the initial first couple of days of the Cedar Fire. So that's the reason for the Inyaha Memorial. This is the drainage. Looking up that way, I kind of described on the bus, maybe you didn't hear some, but just before we turned in, Wednesday morning, October 29th, as I'm driving out, I'm going to go down to the bottom of the hill, meet with a guy that's going to be the next 24-hour period. He'll have Division B, or excuse me, Branch 3, Ray Cheney. We had burned from Pine Hills Road all across Wainola, which is across this country here, firing to keep the fire on this side of Highway 78, this being Highway 78 right here. There was a piece we couldn't get done. There wasn't enough time in the night to make it happen. That morning, the fire spotted across Highway 78, and that was that little, again, that little blip that ran up there. Engineer Rucker from Novato perished on the hill that's just out of sight, right back over there. It's behind, it'll be kind of like just to the left of, but farther back than that square brown house that you can see right there. And that was approximately noon on Wednesday, October 29th. Certainly, there was a west wind blowing at that time. The fire made that sort of unusual little run. And everything lined up. One of the things that hopefully that I'm hoping that comes out of that is that there's an increased awareness that when local municipalities, and I'm not going to go way into this because it's more personal opinion than agency stuff, but the local municipalities, when they're sending structures, Type 1 strike teams out for structure protection, I think that everyone agrees that we need to increase the level of their training, especially insofar as the look up, look down, look around type of training, when you're in trouble, when to engage, how to approach structure protection. The reality of it is, as a fire commander, when we receive these local agency strike teams, there's a spectrum of experience and training that they're going to be on somewhere, and it's really hard to determine exactly where that is unless you know them. If you don't know them, you got to go by what they tell you or interpolate what they tell you, and so it's hard to get a good feel. So you send them out, you give them the briefings, you give them the warnings. And I'm not trying to say they don't know what they're doing. It's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is we don't have a good feel for where on the spectrum they are. And so enhanced training in this respect was one of my personal recommendations to the lessons learned efforts that went on after the fire. We did some extensive interviews afterwards, some debriefings. So that's where we are in the landscape. That's what happened to Steve Rucker. That's what's happened here in the past insofar as the 11 fatalities, again, wind-driven fire, November 1959. The wind just flat howls through these canyons here during the late fall time of year. And that's what we wanted to kind of show you right here. This was, again, the headwaters of the San Diego River when we were on that bridge when we first got going this morning. We said, this is the San Diego River. This is where it starts right here. And it continues on up just a short little ways. What we're going to do is go back into Julian, or excuse me, go back down to San Isabel for lunch. And we're just a little ahead of schedule, and I suppose that's okay. Then we're going to go.
Early lunch is okay because we all got up early.
Early lunch is good because we're hungry. Go back up over Julian, down through Cuyamaca State Park, and down Interstate 8 and home.
Hey, Randy, did you say that the crew was lost in this canyon?
Yeah, they were in one of the side drains.